Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Thank you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up, and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was gonna go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
A good evening. Do not attempt to adjust your radio. There is nothing wrong. We have taken control as to bring you this special show. We will return it to you as soon as you are grooving. Welcome to station WEFUNK, better known as We Funk. Or deeper still, the Mothership Connection, home of the extraterrestrial brothers, dealers of funky music, P-Funk, Uncut Funk, The Bomb.
Coming to you directly from the Mothership, top of the chocolate Milky Way, 500,000 kilowatts of P-Funk power. So kick back, dig, while we do it to you in your eardrums. Oh, me, I'm known as Lollipop Man, alias the long-haired sucker. My motto is...
Make mine the P-Funk. I want my funk uncut. Yeah, make my funk the P-Funk. I want to get funked up.
Now this is what I want y'all to do. If you got faults, defects, or shortcomings, you know, like arthritis, rheumatism, or migraines, whatever part of your body it is, I want you to lay it on your radio. Let the vibes flow through. Funk not only moves, it can remove. Dig? The desired effect is what you get when you improve your interplanetary functionship. Sir Lollipop Man, chocolate-coated freaking habit form. Doing it to you in 3D. So groovy that I dig me. Once upon a time called now. Somebody say, is there funk after death? I say, it's 7-Up. Yeah. T-Funk. Uncut funk. Yeah, I dig. Let me put my sunglasses on. That's the law around here. You got to wear your sunglasses so you can feel cool. Gangsta lean. Y'all should dig my sun rooftop. Well, all right. Hey, I was digging on y'all funk for a while. Sound like it got a 3 on it, though, to me. when I was down south and I heard some funk with some main ingredients like Doobie Brothers, Blue Magic, David Bowie. It was cool. But can you imagine Doobie in your funk? Ho! W-E-F-U-N-K. We funk.
Make my funk to be funk.
Ho!
I want my funk uncut.
Oh,
make my
funk
to be funk. I want to get funked up.
Him, I want the
bomb. I want the
P-funk, y'all.
I want the funk that don't. Make my funk to be funk.
Home of the extraterrestrial brothers. Getting deep. Once upon a time, call right now. Ain't it funky now? Make my
peace. Make my funk to
be funk. Wants to get funked up. I want the bomb.
I want the bomb.
Peace funk.
Don't want my funk that song.
Oh, make my
funk to be funk. Before I take it home.
Yeah.
Discussing with the community. We had over 50 participants in that Zoom meeting. And before that Zoom meeting even began, we had individuals coming into our meeting, throwing racial slurs at me and other individuals in the meeting, and telling us to die. And that this is some of the things that the black community here in Evanston has been fighting against for generations, and that this issue does not just stem with housing. And I understand that maybe down the road we may get something done with reparations, that we may someday get direct stimulus checks, that we may get entrepreneurship grants. But this program, as it is incomplete, and it makes no sense to go forward with it. If you put an incomplete bill to Congress, it will not pass, and that same applies here, is that this is a program that is so impactful to the community here in Evanston, the black community here in Evanston, that $25,000 can change an individual's life, especially when the median income level of the black community is $44,000 here in Evanston. So we must tread carefully when we do this, that we must take steps that are positive, that are slow thinking, that we are careful with what we propose and what we do going forward. Because the work that we do here will be impactful across the nation. And we are at the doorstep of greatness. And that's when I said at the beginning of this, is that we're fighting for something greater than just ourselves. That this will impact generations to come. That if we can get this right, like my brother Kevin alluded earlier, that we will make so much positive change here in the United States. That we will close the wealth gap that has been plaguing our community for generations. And I myself am not a legacy family. My family moved here when I was born, 20 years ago. And I have no stake in this as an individual. But I recognize that my brothers and sisters that have been coming here talking, that have been coming to me with their problems, have recognized that this isn't right. And I said to myself that this is something that I believe in, and that all of us believe in, and that's why we're here today. And so I thank you all so incredibly much for coming today and taking the time to listen to what we have to say when it comes to reparations. Thank you so much.
We asked that the city council, the lame duck city council, the city, not vote on this bill and turn it into law. There's a new city council coming in May, and we ask that everyone just wait, go back to the drawing board, make up a bill that's inclusive of all the people. And we realize the limitations of the money. The money is not even in the pot here. And so we're fighting on whether to make this an actual bill going forward, a flawed bill that will stain the reputation of Evanston for time going forward.
Kevin Brown, I'm a community activist here in Evanston. Been affiliated with this community for 40 years. I married into what they call a legacy family of four generations of Evanstonians, and would qualify for the benefit that's being offered in this program. I'm standing here representing my family, other African Americans who are afraid to come forward because of reprisal by the city. We have a history here in Evanston where African Americans who speak out in this city are targeted for retaliation. And so some of us are standing up to speak truth to power. We want to speak about why this program in Evanston is not reparations. Reparations is meant not only to repair past harm for racial discrimination and white supremacy. Reparations are meant to close the racial wealth gap. Reparations are meant to close the racial wealth gap. The program that the city of Evanston is offering does not do that at all. As a matter of fact, in Sacramento, California, the Sacramento Housing and Redevelopment Agency offers a similar program targeted toward African Americans with an even greater benefit of $28,000 that goes toward housing and closing the cost when a person purchases a home. That program is not called reparations. It's called a social equity
housing program that's meant to encourage investment in the African-American community. But it is not reparation. Reparation is meant to close the racial wealth gap, and that's what we want in Evanston. We want a real program. We don't want a program that's a fraud. We don't want a program that is fraudulent and is going to be presented to the United States of America as real reparations. We don't want piecemeal reparations. We want real reparations. We want reparation that's going to make a difference for black people in Evanston, Illinois. We want reparation that's going to lift up black people in Evanston, Illinois. We want reparation that's going to close the racial wealth gap in Evanston, Illinois. So we are here to represent our community, because not only is it important for the Evanston community, it's important for African Americans all over the United States of America. And that's what we're representing today. This is important. This is not some small thing. We don't want a program that is not reparations to be represented across the country that will have a negative impact on other black people across America.
We are so excited in the city of Evanston to be nationally recognized for such an exploratory feature of repair of damages to African Americans and blacks who have experienced damage through slavery and injustice throughout our years of being here. However, as I talk to my neighbors and explore the fact that this was rolled out in a way that is not representing what was told to the neighbor in the beginning. To have neighbors go to an initial meeting over a year ago and talk about they would be receiving a check from the city of Evanston, to have it introduced in city council as if it was a housing supplement for African Americans. I have received the first-time buyer program for my home that I've owned over 20 years before this program was even introduced. To now see that they are using this title as if this is what the citizens, over 100 suggestions were made throughout these meetings. These could possibly affect anywhere from tens of thousands to 100,000 African Americans that have passed through the Evanston city limits. How does this only concentrate on one aspect of the injustice that we have received here in Evanston as black people?
This is not true reparations. This is not what the people of Evanston want. I want to make it perfectly clear that Evanston does want reparations and that I want reparations for Evanston. But as a model for what the nation may look to in moving forward with their own reparations program, I cannot stress enough how important it is to get this right. And it is not right. And three of the aldermen who would potentially be voting on Monday, two of them have already lost their elections, and one of them is stepping down. On a council of nine people, there is no reason to rush this program. Where we are right now is that there's a lot of community interest, and there are a lot of people paying attention now. And now is the time that we should be getting good input from the community about what they truly want, not some sort of, you know, botched housing program, because that's not what reparations is meant to be. Reparations is meant to repair harm, not to cause further harm, not to cause further dissension or divisiveness, as previous speakers have mentioned.
To insinuate that racism has stopped after 1969, or that the people who live here currently aren't experiencing racism by their police, by their schools, by their banks, by the housing of this entire city, just putting money into a loan is not true reparations. And we would just like to say that this should not be rushed, following what Mrs. Keenan just said about aldermen who are not currently or not going to serve next. They shouldn't still be making decisions for the community. And we just want to stand behind Evanston Rejects Racist Reparations and say that we want true reparations.
The nation's first government-backed reparations initiative for Black Americans was approved this week in Evanston, Illinois. It's a program that could serve as a model for reparations efforts across the country. John Yang has the story. It's part of our Race Matters series.
Judy, Evanston, Illinois is a suburb on Chicago's North Side lakefront. It's the home of Northwestern University. About 16% of its 75,000 residents are Black. This week, the Evanston City Council voted 8-1 to begin to make good on its promise to spend $10 million in reparations over 10 years. First up, $400,000 to compensate for past discriminatory housing practices. Individual grants of up to $25,000 a person to Black residents who can show they or their families lived in the city between 1919 and 1969. The money can be used for down payments, mortgage payments, repairs, or home improvements. Almost all the money will come from taxes on the sale of recreational marijuana. Dr. Ron Daniels is the convener of the National African American Reparations Commission, and he joins us now. Dr. Daniels, thanks so much for being with us. What's the significance of what Evanston City Council did this week? This has been a topic of discussion for a very long time, but this appears to be the first government to actually do something about it.
The significance is that Evanston now becomes a model. It becomes a blueprint for reparations initiatives across the country. And there are other cities who are quite interested in this as well. So Providence, Rhode Island, Asheville, North Carolina, Los Angeles, Seattle, Washington, there are a number of cities that are interested in this. And so this becomes the blueprint. And it's very significant because beyond the idea of it, we now have a tangible example of moving from idea to public policy, and Evanston has set the tone.
And it's also been a topic of discussion in Congress. There have been discussions about bills that would provide federal, national reparations. Do you think that it's going to give that effort an impetus as well?
There's no question about it, and there's really a kind of synergistic relationship between Evanston and a number of cities around the country because many of them have endorsed H.R. 40. Alderman Robin Ruth Simmons, who led the effort in Evanston, certainly was instrumental in getting that done. And at the federal level, the brilliant and courageous leadership of Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has moved us to the point where I would predict within the next, maybe the next 3 months or so, we'll actually have a commission set up that will study and develop reparations proposals for African Americans. That's a huge development. It also enjoys the support of Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, Cindy Hoyer, and, of course, powered by a tremendous coalition of organizations, the American Civil Liberties Union and COBRA, Samuel D. Rip Proctor Conference, National Council of Churches, Human Rights Watch, Center for American Progress. This is an incredible moment in the history of the United States of America.
I want to ask you about the specifics of what Evanston did this week. The one no vote on the city council came from Cicely Fleming. She's a Black member of the council. She argued that the specifics of how this money should be spent was almost paternalistic. She said that the injured party should be the one to dictate and decide what reparations are. What do you think of that?
Well, she's correct. What she's incorrect about is not understanding that the reason why the National African American Reparations Commission certified Evanston as a model is because we were very deeply involved in helping them to put the program together. And when Alderman Robin Ruth Simmons and her colleagues did town hall meetings and hearings across the city, what came back from the persons who are affected was over and over again, housing, 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 housing. And so therefore, that's why the initial reparatory housing initiative was conceived by the stakeholders and went on to the reparations subcommittee and ultimately approved by city council. So I think that the alderwoman has her right to her opinion, and we think that's good. We need a lot of debate, a lot of discussion. There were others who thought it should be cash payments and so forth. All of that, quite frankly, is positive because this is not the end of the initiative in Evanston, Illinois. This is really the beginning. There will be many, many other opportunities in order to have reparations initiatives. I should say this, however, the relationship between the national and the federal is it will really take federal legislation to really create the large amount of resources to deal with the injury over the centuries. No amount of money is enough, or cash or whatever is enough. but at least the federal government, under the leadership of Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee and the coalition I referenced, will be the way in which this ultimately does the kind of repair that's needed.
Dr. Ron Daniels of the National African American Reparations Commission, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Giving the green light tonight on how to spend the first phase of funding for the city's reparations fund.
That vote happening really inside the last half hour, and WGN's Brona Tumulty is at City Hall right now with the very latest. Brona.
Good evening, guys. Yeah, it was an 8-1 vote tonight in favor of passing that first initiative, which will see 16 eligible African-American residents here in Evanston being allocated $25,000 each towards things like a new home or home repairs. But this was a lengthy meeting with many people weighing in on how they feel about the program.
As a housing program, I think it's great. As a reparations program, this falls very flat to me.
Ninth Ward Alderman Cicely Fleming is talking about a proposed housing initiative in Evanston to help counteract historically discriminatory housing practices.
The proposal in front of us is housing plan, and so the proposal will allow 16 residents to access $25,000 apiece towards a new mortgage, you know, their existing mortgage or home renovation.
Back in 2019, the city created the reparations fund using tax revenue from recreational marijuana, committing $10 million over the span of a decade. But Fleming says using the first $400,000 in funding in this way doesn't feel quite right.
To myself and lots of residents who have voiced this concern is that, you know, the money will go directly to a bank or a mortgage lender or a contractor.
Some residents who feel that way speaking out tonight at the city council meeting.
I think that what's been proposed is admirable. It is a sound housing and equity program, but it doesn't quite rise to the stature of what I would constitute, what most people understand as reparations.
But many others feel this is where we begin in making things right.
We're talking about a remedy of 4% of a $10 million budget, and I just want to remind us that the wisdom of the ages says that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step.
Including Journey Shannon, who owns a business in town.
It has been wonderful. Evanston has really been kind since we opened up the doors in November.
She tells us she's firmly behind approving the first allocation.
You have to start someplace. And if you oppose it, what are you suggesting?
And that after this, there is plenty of time to look at how best the rest of the money can be spent.
Well, I would like to say programs will be established so people can learn new trades and new skills, but we don't all need a check. Some of us just need to learn how to be better business people, learn how to do vocational skills. So I think everyone will be benefited, but it's not always going to be a monetary reward in this moment.
Now again, that final vote tonight, 8-1 in favor of passing the first phase as it stands. Coming up on WGN News at 10, we'll tell you more about who exactly qualifies for this first phase and when it is expected to be up and running. We're live in Evanston, Brona Tumulty, WGN News.
Today we're recognizing a first, and it's been centuries in the making. Evanston, Illinois, just north of Chicago, has become the first city in the country to fund a reparations bill. The city is committing $10 million to pay its black citizens for generations of losses caused by the city's history of structural racism, redlining, and segregation. Eligible black people can receive up to $25,000 each to use for housing. The money will come from tax revenue collected from the sales of recreational marijuana. The bill was spearheaded by Evanston Alderman Robin Rue Simmons, who called reparations the only legislative response for us to reconcile the damages in the black community. She expects the Evanston City Council to vote next week to approve the first $400,000 from the reparations fund. That despite pressure from some people who are encouraging city leaders to abandon the plan. Robin joins me now to discuss. I love this idea. I love this that this is happening because it's such a big deal. You worked with a historian to put together a 77-page report about how black people have historically been harmed, which I think is important because you always want to lead with the data. What did you find that was convincing enough, you know, to get folks on board to approve this money for reparations?
So thank you for having me. I'm really proud of our city and what we've done so far. The vote is actually on March 22nd, but we had a narrative. We could see just by drive-by that there was a racial disparity in our city. There was a black neighborhood that was inferior aesthetically, had less community amenities, no school, less economic opportunity, and there was a white neighborhood throughout most of Evanston that is affluent and aesthetically beautiful. And so Dino Robinson of Shorefront Legacy Museum actually helped with an extensive report that's now over 100 pages that shows exactly the details. In 1919, there were anti-Black housing policies that restricted Black residents to living in a specific part of the West End of the Fifth Ward, is where I was born and raised and currently serve. And those policy and practices that were enforced obviously limited the Black community to gaining wealth through housing equity and the opportunity to the lived experience that is enjoyed by most of Evanston. 1969 is significant because that's when redlining was outlawed and fair housing was passed and enforced here in Evanston. So our policy guidelines are for residents that lived here during that time or their direct descendants. And it was important that we respond with our reparative justice in line with the documented injury. And in our case for reparations, it's found in housing policy and zoning.
So is that the reason why you targeted this particular assistance towards housing and mortgage assistance, because of the direct link to previous discriminatory policies like redlining? Was it easier to do it when you targeted it towards that than just give money to people generally for you know, use on any other thing?
Absolutely. So we have a very thoughtful case, one that is based on data and historic facts, and it will be much easier if there should be any sort of legal challenge for us to defend a action that was legitimately enforced on our books, and housing was an action. So our policy specifically states housing and economic opportunity as ways that we will bring redress for the Black community. And it is important that they are aligned with one another so that the defense is solid. Now, we understand that this is one area of repair needed of many in the Black community. Anti-Blackness and oppression, segregation has impacted us greatly beyond even housing, understanding education and business and understanding that other institutions, the financial institution in particularly, the appraisal industry, the educational institutions, and other levels of government, including H.R. 40, must be passed as well for us to get towards full repair in the Black community. But what we've done in Evanston is decided to take the first tangible step, a small step in the right direction towards repair and justice for the Black community. Again, this initiative is only the first 4% of the total fund. And we look to work with the community to develop more initiatives to attract more funding, which is happening already. Very proud to say that we've had a synagogue, a Catholic church, private residences, and businesses that have committed and started to contribute to the fund to grow the fund beyond $10 million so that we might do even more than this initial housing remedy.
I love that, because that means that you sort of have the community pulling together and pulling their own funds together to sort of raise up folks within that community. In terms of how you determine who's eligible, you said it's folks that have generational links to those in that community who did suffer from the oppressive policies like redlining and discrimination in housing. So how do they prove that? How do they prove the generational ties to those folks?
So there are several ways, and that will come back to City Council on the 22nd of March. And we had a community hospital here is where all Black residents at a period in history were born. We had a Black school. We have historical archives at Shorefront Legacy Center, as well as the Evanston History Center, including old phone books. There are school records. And then, of course, there are birth records and other more state official documents. But we're going to have a robust list of ways that residents can prove their identity, their residency, and their race, their lineage, and that will be how they qualify for reparations in Evanston. And I want to add that we're also looking at ways.
Man, I didn't think I would. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I was saying we're looking at ways that we can have collective benefits. So residents that aren't necessarily interested or prepared for homeownership or own a home already they can have access to some sort of reparations as well. And these are additional programming that we look forward to introducing as we continue to roll out this program over the next 10 years.
I was just going to say that it's so cool that you said old phone books, because I'm like, I mean, folks at home, don't throw those out. Maybe there's proof in there if you live in Evanston that you have ties and you would be able to get reparations for housing, which is something you probably never thought you would need that for. Robin Russeman, thank you so much for being here. We'll have you back around the 22nd and that vote, because I'm very curious to see how this turns out. Please stay safe. Hi, I'm Zerlina Maxwell.
40 acres and a mule, a phrase passed through my grandparents and their grandparents, probably yours as well. The promise to free black people in America was that after centuries of bondage, they would get their fair share. Since then, the fight for reparations has continued. And to this day, that promise remains unfulfilled. But then there's Evanston, Illinois, a small community outside of Chicago that has taken a bold and controversial step. Will the rest of the country follow? Nightline anchor Byron Pitts has the story.
Early in my childhood, I was invited to have a play date. My white friend never had a play date at my home. So I went to Megan's house. The streets were wider. The homes were bigger and brighter.
It was obvious that it was the barrier of race that kept us from that, because the segregation was race-based.
Even here, Evanston, Illinois, a proudly liberal suburb of Chicago, the barrier and burden of race have long weighed heavy, like a winter storm. Evanston's alderman for the 5th Ward, Robin Rue Simmons, was born and raised in the historically black neighborhood she represents.
This community was redlined historically, and that has come along with damages that continue today. Resources were stripped away from the black community, along with wealth as well.
The city's plan to change that? Reparations. An idea long debated, proposed over 150 years ago. First, 40 acres of land, later a mule, for formerly enslaved people to share the American dream built on their backs for free.
We built this nation!
A promise long broken, until now.
This is a historic vote.
Evanston is set to become the first U.S. city to pay out reparations, a total of $10 million, starting with increments of up to $25,000 per person for housing.
I didn't start my elected career even discussing reparations.
So what
Never.
Changed?
I was looking at data. I was looking at what we had done, and reparations was the only answer.
The only answer?
The only
the
answer.
The only answer.
The only, any more of the same was going to only, at best, help us sustain the oppressed state and the disparity that we have.
Only? That's a big word.
The
only
legislative response for us to reconcile the damages in the black community is reparations.
We anticipate litigation with the premise that you cannot use tax money that's from the public to benefit a particular group of people. But throughout history, taxes were used to benefit a certain group of people while others were excluded from that.
Dino Robinson is the founder of Shorefront, an archive dedicated to chronicling and celebrating black life in Evanston, a richness long undervalued. His documentation going back to the late 1800s, invaluable in measuring the cost of racism and the need for reparations.
Black community members were moving throughout Evanston and forming, you know, pockets in the city of Evanston. And it caused the white community to start panicking, like, what do we do about this?
The response to that panic? Redlining, a federally sanctioned project, assigning market value to neighborhoods, a grading system, A to D.
The D areas were usually relegated to the black community. The area D was always in red.
This deliberately pushed Evanston's black families into an area that became the 5th Ward, segregating them from white families, sought after property, and ultimately, wealth.
banks in Evanston would not loan to black families. Real estate agencies would not show you anything other than the Fifth Ward.
That map still is the map of our concentrated black community, our disinvestment.
Today, white residents of Evanston have nearly double the income and home value of black residents. This racial wealth gap is prevalent nationally, with black Americans possessing less than 15% of the wealth that white Americans have.
I am 98 years old.
We moved to Evanston in 1959.
This is a lot.
Black residents who lived through redlining and their descendants are eligible for reparations. That includes Ben Gaines Sr. and his son, Ben Jr. Ben Sr. grew up in 1920s Dixon, Kentucky, part of the Old South, the business end of an era's most violent weapon against African Americans, Jim Crow. He landed in Evanston. Here, Jim Crow wore a smile, but still inflicted harm on black home buyers.
The contractor, he said, find a lot anywhere in Evanston and I'll build whatever you want. Well, when he said that, he meant in the black neighborhoods. And we still have these same types of problems.
Uncle Ben is a realist. He calls it like he sees it.
Younger members of Ben Sr.'s family, his grandnephew Jared and his children, Nick and Maya, know a more progressive era.
Growing up in Evanston for me was definitely good, despite the racism that I faced.
Will you apply for the reparations?
I will, yeah.
And why?
Because it's old.
Quote-unquote wealthy African Americans are not the equivalent of quote-unquote wealthy white Americans in this country.
A national reparations policy is a moral, democratic, and economic imperative.
House Resolution 40 is the latest national step toward reparations. Supporters have included Ta-Nehisi Coates and actor Danny Glover.
H.R. 40 was an opportunity to have a commission to study reparations, but also the further context in which we look at slavery and the impact that it had on us.
So you think Evanston could be an example for the nation?
I think it can. Evanston, Illinois did something that no other city has done. If we're able to use that as a platform, maybe other cities might adopt the whole idea of this.
And other cities could take up Evanston's sweetly ironic funding solution, a 3% tax on newly legal marijuana sales.
It's the most appropriate use for that sales tax. And in our city, 70% of the marijuana arrests were in the black community, and we're 16% of the community. All studies show that blacks and whites consume cannabis at the same rate.
There's been debate over whether those taxes can sustain the fund long term. And even those who proudly support reparations wonder aloud, is $25,000 too little, too late?
It's a drop in the bucket. You have denied me all my 98 years. Hopefully, before I die, I'll see the world change.
Uncle Ben, he's 98, so we can understand his skepticism. Where does your skepticism come from?
I would say it's less like skepticism and more education. People who are acting like they're ready for change and behind closed doors, other things are happening, right? And we see that all the time in politics.
What does it say that my 25-year-old has to feel like that?
You don't learn about these issues at your high school.
We aren't really taught black history outside of, oh, you know, slaves came from Africa. So part of reparations, it can't just be money. Like, you have to teach us what we need to know.
One could argue it's potentially more symbolic than it is substantive.
I disagree that it's symbolic at all. I understand that $25,000 is life-saving for some families.
But relative to the injury, it's not nearly enough, and I get that.
This notion of reparations in Evanston isn't meant to be a drop in the bucket, but the beginning of a stream that becomes a river, that becomes
Absolutely.
An ocean.
There is a lifetime of work ahead for us to get to justice.
For all of your work in this space, what worries you still?
Not enough resource, not quick enough. I do believe that we're committed as a city, and I can't wait to celebrate the family that receives their first reparation benefit. I cannot wait for that day.
Hi, everyone. George Stephanopoulos here. Thanks for checking out the ABC News YouTube channel. If you'd like to get more videos, show highlights, and watch live event coverage, click on the right over here to subscribe to our channel. And don't forget to download the ABC News app for breaking news alerts. Thanks for watching.
All right. Today's podcast is titled Restorative Housing Reparations. That's what they call it up in Evanston, Illinois. So the podcast was titled Restorative Housing Reparations, Evanston Style. And we're giving you some background audio on what on Monday they passed this thing. And I think, 16 families, for starters, will receive a 20, and they have this qualification for this. You have to be linked to somebody, bloodline or marriage or whatever, that was in Evanston between the years of 1919, I think, to 1969. All right. And then you'll get and you have to be African American. And you have to, well, those are the basics. There are probably some other qualifications, but I think they have money. Approved money for 16 of these grants of $25,000 to either buy a house or get repairs on a house. Once again, it's titled up in Evanston, Illinois, Restorative Housing Reparations. Now, it has nothing to do with slavery. In my opinion, well, not even my opinion, they're using the word reparations as a marketing tool. But in any event, let's go to another audio. We're going to open this up for the phone lines to get your thoughts on restorative housing reparations. That's what they're calling it up in Evanston, Illinois, which is the first city. Well, it's Asheville, North Carolina has got something going on, but Evanston, Illinois is the first to have some money actually set aside.
We're learning more about the Biden administration's plans for reparations. At the White House press briefing Wednesday, Politico reporter Eugene Daniels asked Press Secretary Jen Psaki about how the president would tackle the issue.
Well, he supported a study of reparations, which I believe is what's being discussed, and studying the continuing impacts of slavery, which is being discussed in this hearing on H.R. 40, I believe it is. And he continues to demonstrate his commitment to take comprehensive action to address the systemic racism that persists today. Obviously, that is having that study is a part of that.
Maya King reports the president supports the idea behind the bill, and Vice President Kamala Harris endorsed it when she was in the Senate. But as Maya reports, that might not be enough to get a proposal to study reparations for slavery to Biden's desk this Congress. And Maya joins me now from Washington. She's a politics reporter for Politico. Hi there, Maya. Thanks very much for being with us. So can you give us some background, first of all, on the bill known as H.R. 40?
The bill was introduced in 1989 originally, so it's been introduced in every Congress now for more than three decades. It establishes a commission to actually study the impact of slavery on African-American communities and the role that the United States government played in perpetuating these systems that may have impacted Black communities negatively. Now, the challenge with actually passing it, of course, really lies in a disconnect between what representatives would like to ultimately see this commission achieve. Some are nervous or skeptical of using perhaps taxpayer dollars to fund direct payments to African Americans, while others, especially Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas, who has now sponsored the legislation for three Congresses, have maintained that this is really just to establish a commission, to begin the process of understanding exactly the harms done as a result of enslavement and several policies, and how Congress can begin to recommend ways to rectify those harms.
And Maya, why has this gained momentum in the past couple of years?
In 2019, actually, was when we really saw the most attention paid to this legislation. As you mentioned, Vice President Kamala Harris actually signed on to the Senate version of this piece of legislation as a co-sponsor. And now it's gained more traction this year in part because of the role that the Biden administration has played in saying that they support racial equity legislation, and the fact that over the last year, the racial inequities, particularly the impact of the coronavirus, economic downturn, the housing crisis as a result of a lack of funds in communities of color specifically, all of these have really underlined the need for support and the racial inequities that exist that have distinctly and disproportionately impacted Black communities. A number of reparations experts and advocates that I spoke to ahead of yesterday's hearing really emphasized the fact that this hearing is being held for the first time in many years within the first 100 days of a presidential administration. And so they point to that as one positive step, or at least something that they can say represents this issue really being taken seriously, not just by Congress, but by the White House as well.
And you note that it's not clear how committed the White House is to H.R. 40 just yet, but before it can get to Mr. Biden's desk, of course, Congress has to pass it. So what are the specific challenges there?
Well, the biggest challenge to passing this legislation, of course, is making sure that Democrats have the vote. Also, in talking with reparations experts, not just on the advocacy side, but those on the Hill, have pointed out the Democrats' slim majority in Congress is one impediment to passing this legislation, because not only are Republicans vehemently opposed to this bill, moderate Democrats have really been more in favor of more piecemeal approaches to rectifying the issues and racial inequities that we see. Some have supported housing vouchers instead of a reparations committee. Some have also proposed universal programs that might not necessarily apply specifically to Black communities, but could disproportionately impact them in a positive way. And I should also note, as my colleague Eugene asked during yesterday's press briefing, President Biden is also in a position to use an executive order, actually, to establish this commission, which would then give Congress the responsibility of moving or leapfrogging a bit forward to actually begin recommending a reparations program or drafting legislation that would go beyond the scope of a commission to actually starting to understand really what these programs would look like in practice. So there are several steps that have to be taken, obviously, here for this to even make it to the president's desk. But Democrats and advocates, those who are really in favor of passing this bill, say that this year, if not over the next 4 years, is kind of their last shot at really making this a reality.
And Maya, just to be clear, what would actually happen if the legislation was somehow able to sort of garner enough support, if those lawmakers were able to garner enough support for the legislation, and it did pass?
So it's clear that, Democrats are confident that this has a fighting chance in the House. They can get the votes that they need to pass this in the House, and perhaps if they can really be clear about the language here, move it through the Senate. And if it does pass and make it to President Biden's desk, what this would do is establish a commission of around 13 experts in finance, in economics, in sociology, in history, to study the impacts, the lingering impacts of enslavement, Jim Crow laws, and other systemic measures that have really impacted and negatively impacted Black communities. And from there, make recommendations to Congress about what exactly the reparations program could look like.
All right, Maya King of Politico. Maya, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Today's podcast is titled Reparations, Restorative Housing Reparations, Evanston Style. Restorative Housing Reparations, that's the brand that the town of Evanston, Illinois, outside of Chicago, they have, their local government has, I guess I can use the word successfully, together a reparations, let's say, brand, it's not based on slavery. It's not based on slavery at all. Part of the qualifications to get the $25,000 grant is that you must have been connected to the city of Evanston, Illinois, between the years of 1919, I believe, to 1969. Now, there's some other particulars which I'm not familiar with right now, but those two things, you had to be black and you had to be in Evanston in the years between 1990 and some other things. The qualifier for the grant. Now, this is just the start. Other cities that are looking at Evanston, Asheville, North Carolina, is working on their own version of reparations as well. But the Evanston one so far, that is not based on the slave or the human trafficking transactions or dealings from what we traditionally call the slave period here in the United States. Now, I've played some clips that you've heard some people, some citizens of Evanston. You've got some citizens of Evanston. The very first clip I played, they don't think that what was passed on Monday is adequate. So they were encouraging their legislators not to pass it. And then you've heard some audios from some politicians up there that are all for it. But the bottom line, so far, they passed it on Monday night. So although these, I think the first 16 or so people, they will not get a check. They want to buy a down payment. I mean, if they need a down payment, I think they can get a grant up to $25,000. Or if they need repairs on their home, $25,000 worth of work. Now, on the receipt, now, I don't have to get queued up. As Umar Johnson said, and I have to agree with Umar on this, there are white folks, matter of fact, there are white folks that now have only been praying for black folks to get reparations, and we're going to cater this towards Evansville in this conversation. Let's look at the landscape. There were white union building trades leaders sitting down with lobbyists. There were white contractors or Asian contractors, everybody but black contractors that were sitting down with lobbyists to craft a reparations bill to pass around the table to all the legislators, town of Evanston, Illinois, including the mayor, all right, along with bankrolling all of their pet projects and or elections around the table, because what they wanted is, all right, if this is passed, because we're writing the rules, we're dictating the rules. So when these people receive their $25,000, we're going to be the recipient of the $25,000. Personally, I think what's happening in Evanston is putting black folks who, I believe this is the reparations okey-doke, are on a fast track to hell. Simply because, historically speaking, there has never been, to my knowledge, you can call in the 619-768-2945 if you know different. There's never been a government entitled program that somebody got rich off of, number one, that who received it now. There's never been a recipient of a government program that got wealthy on it. Or even the racial wealth gap. There's never been one to my knowledge. If you know of one, call and let me know. That includes Section 8. there's so many housing programs out here that already exist that mirror what Evanston, all Evanston did was take a housing program which is available in all 50 states on a local, state, and federal level, and then put their brand on it, which is restorative housing reparations. That's their brand of a housing grant that has been in existence for decades already. But a lot of people go for the okey-doke. But name, once again, call me, because I don't know. I've never heard of anybody who's on the receiving end of one of these grants that have come out ahead. Now, they might have, you know, got an apartment or a house to live in for a while. I mean, there are people on Section 8 that I've run across who've been evicted, and their portion of the rent was only $5. Before I go to the phone lines here, here's how I look at reparations. You need to stop counting the white man's money. It doesn't matter what Lloyds of London made off of slavery. It doesn't matter what IBM is making. It doesn't matter that Georgetown University in the early days had slaves in the plantation. All that doesn't matter. When you're counting somebody else's money, it's the 10th commandment, actually, coveting. When you're coveting what somebody else has got, you automatically blind yourself with what you can get right now and here and now. I'm going to play this one clip, then we'll go to the phone lines if you guys want to talk about this, of one lady, African-American, and she's just one among many. They're white ones too, but in this example, it's going to be a black woman. That she won $188 million. Oh, do I have this up? Oh, no, you know what? Well, you know, before I do that, because there's another way to do this. When you don't look at what somebody else is making, here's what you can do. I'm going to play this. This is about Kanye West and Tyler Perry.
Kanye West, Grammy-winning musician, fashion designer, and now billionaire. Back in 2016, West himself declared he was over $50 million in debt. So how did he climb out of this hole, and where does his money come from? After a decade-long earnings analysis, Forbes can confirm that Kanye West is worth $1.3 billion. Though West grew famous for his music, his fortune comes mostly from his Adidas-powered Yeezy sneaker line. West receives around 11% royalty of Yeezy revenue, which in 2019 was close to $1.3 billion. West owns Yeezy outright, while Adidas manufactures and distributes the shoes, a dream team setup. As the markets begin to recover after free-falling in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, Adidas shares have surged, and so did West's wealth. Let's not forget his nice things. Private jets, Lamborghini, his new Wyoming ranch, and the Los Angeles home he shares with wife Kim Kardashian West. After crunching the numbers, we think it's safe to finally say, Kanye West is a billionaire.
Tyler Perry is an actor, writer, director, producer, and billionaire. But he didn't get to where he is easily. Perry was born into a poor family in New Orleans. He was abused as a child, having a painful and lonely adolescence. Then, Oprah happened.
Hi, everybody!
She had a segment about how journaling could be therapeutic, and it clicked with him. Writing became his outlet, and he channeled all his hurt and abuse and rage into letters, which became the inspiration for his first play, I Know I've Been Changed. he moved to Atlanta and invested his life savings into this production. It was not a hit. There wasn't anyone in the audience when it had its opening night in 1992. But Perry was determined to not let his play fail, so he lived out of his car while he tweaked the production, designing the set, making programs, hanging lights, even selling snacks during intermission. His dedication paid off, and the play toured from 1998 to 2000. He invested his profits into his second play, I Can Do Bad All By Myself, that introduced the famous character of Medea, which Perry played himself. It was supposed to tour only 5 cities, but audiences really liked Medea.
Who done got murdered? Somebody got murdered?
Tyler Perry played her all around the country. Now, let's just have this on record. Before he ever had a TV show, before he ever had a movie, Tyler Perry took in more than $100 million from theater ticket sales, $20 million from merchandise, and another $30 million from videos of the performances. Oprah became a fan of Perry, inviting him on her talk show for the first time in 2001. On stage, they had an emotional conversation about resilience. Backstage, Oprah told him the secret to her success: own everything. Just like he did with his first play, Tyler Perry invested his own money into his first Hollywood movie. And again, critics hated it, but his fans showed up. In its opening weekend, Diary of a Mad Black Woman was number one at the box office, bringing in nearly $22 million. Executives were finally starting to give credit to Tyler Perry. 2 years after Diary of a Mad Black Woman, his first TV show, House of Pain, became the highest-rated, first-run syndicated cable show of all time. So far, he's written and produced more than 1,200 episodes of television in the past 15 years. The Medea franchise was retired in 2019. Those 11 movies grossed more than $670 million, with Tyler taking a $290 million profit. That same year, he also opened Tyler Perry Studios, a 330-acre property in Atlanta with 12 sound stages and custom sets that include a White House that was built to scale. And he took note of what Oprah told him. Perry owns the entirety of his creative output. More than 1,200 episodes of television, 22 feature films, and at least 24 stage plays. Oh, and ViacomCBS pays him $150 million a year for new content, and he has an equity stake in the streaming service BET+. Behind the camera or in front of the camera, Tyler Perry continues to be one of the highest paid, hardest working, and most prolific multi-hyphenates in the game.
Okay, those are two examples, and not everybody's going to do what those two did. I mean, there are less than 3,000 billionaires around the planet, but the reason why I use those examples is, number one, they've done it in this lifetime. Number two, they came from dire straits. Broke, Tyler Perry, homeless, living in his car. And essentially, the common denominator with them, as well as everybody around the planet, including people that want reparations in one form or another, everybody has ideas. Ideas are essentially intellectual property. There's a division of law, a study called intellectual property. And all they did was take their intellectual property, their idea or ideas, and monetize them. That's what they did. Now, they didn't use, there's no government program that's going to do that for you. Now, I found a clip that I wanted to play for you guys. Now, here's an example of a woman. She won the lottery for $188 million. And let's see what happened to her.
Just a lottery ticket. Myself, I usually wait until the jackpot gets into the $200 to $500 million range. Then I'll buy a ticket, and like so many others, allow myself to dream about what I would do should I win, what trips I would take, what people I would tell off. But like the vast majority of the people who purchase tickets, I'm usually a loser. But there are winners. Marie Holmes was a winner. Let's listen to her.
11, 13, 25.
Numbers that will change 26-year-old Marie Holmes' life forever.
I don't know if I want to cry, smile, what. Like, I'm just grateful for this moment.
The Scotchman and Shalote buzzing.
Whoever won, I wish the best for them.
That they sold the ticket, making multi-million dollar dreams come true.
I feel happy for whoever won. I wish it had been me.
Some are seeing dollar signs they missed out on.
I'm still kicking myself in the butt because I was going to get me some, and I never did do it.
But for Marie Holmes, the last-minute decision to buy the ticket is a big game-changer.
I'm thankful that I can bless my kids with something that I didn't have.
Three daughters and one son. Holmes used to work at Walmart and McDonald's, but isn't employed right now. But she's planning on giving the money...
Thank God for this blessing.
...to the man up above.
First, I'm going to pay my tithes because I wouldn't have none of it went for guys.
As for spending it on the fun stuff, she doesn't know quite yet.
It'll hit me soon.
But what she does know is these numbers...
39, 54...
...are ones she'll never forget.
We're rich! We're rich! Woo!
Now, for people that live in North Carolina, that was actually our first time seeing Marie Holmes. For America, for everybody that's in America, I think the first time was when she appeared on Good Morning America, and I'm going to play that clip a little later on. But I have to be honest. When I first saw Marie Holmes, my first thought was, she ain't going to have that money long. And, you know, I hate myself for having that thought because it was just, me being, me stereotyping, you know, because my impression was, okay, this is some hood rat got some money, and she's going to do some hood rat things with it. And then, of course, you know, the cat that was standing behind her yelling, we won, you know, looked like he was going to help her spend all the money. But it was just me being, you know, like I said, stereotyping, thinking that she was a hood rat. And really, all she did was, you know, if I look at it objectively, it was just a young lady dressed casually, tobogging on, because it was pretty, you know, it was probably a little chilly, whatever. But like I said, she just had the little hood rat persona about her, and I sort of said, okay, well, she's going to lose that money. But to her credit, her next appearances kind of changed my mind a little bit. Watch this.
One-third of a $564 million jackpot, $188 million. And I now want to present Marie with a ceremonial big check.
You seem just so nonchalant.
I'm still processing it. It's not hit me yet, but I'm still processing it.
What are your plans?
My plans... I'm not sure, like, I'm relying on my financial advisors. Like,
see? Cleaned up nicely, well-spoken, even said something about having a financial planner. My first impression, maybe a little bit off. And watch this next clip with her on Good Morning America.
You officially wake up this morning as a millionaire. You have the money in hand in the bank. Is it finally sinking in now what's happened to you?
No, not at all. No, I still don't believe it. I don't know when I'm going to actually believe it.
How often did you play the lottery?
Not often. Probably a month at a time. Like, I don't.
Man, check out Miss Holmes. Hair tight, outfit tight, well-spoken on the national stage. Hood rat, shut your mouth, Mr. C. Edward Baldwin. Don't know what you're talking about. Eat your words. Not so fast. Rotate.
This video you will only see on WECT. Our cameras rolling as agents searched a recent Powerball winner's home.
Agents cited millionaire Marie Holmes for having marijuana. Tonight, we've learned she's also a paid validated gang member's $3 million bond just one day after collecting her winnings. Good evening, and thanks for joining us tonight. I'm Ashley Kosakowski.
And I'm John Evans. This is a story that thousands of you have been clicking on and talking about on our Facebook page and on our website and mobile app. Agents swarmed Marie Holmes' house in Brunswick County last night, arresting a drug suspect who lives inside. WECT's Bailey Hicks live now with more details on what happened next. Bailey?
John, agents smelled marijuana when they got to the house that Marie Holmes shares with Lamar McDowell. He's facing heroin trafficking charges, and he's also a validated gang member. According to officials, they arrested him for missing curfew and violating his pretrial release. Then because of that marijuana smell, they came back with search warrants. They found marijuana paraphernalia, and they also apparently found a pistol. That's when they cited lottery winner Marie Holmes for drug possession. Today we also learned the reason why McDowell was out of jail. In court, it came out that Holmes paid his $3 million bond. It was posted just one day after she turned in her winning lottery ticket and collected the lump sum prize, a total of $88 million after taxes. Reporting live in the studio, Bailey Hicks, WEC.
Now, this was actually one case where I wanted to be wrong. I did not want Marie Holmes to be a hood rat. Even though, like I said in the beginning, she had a hood rat persona about her. And I was hoping I was wrong because I didn't want her to do some hood rat things with that money. But as you can see here, one of the first things she did was something hood rat. You know, you spend $3 million getting a loser out of jail, bringing him back around your four kids, allowing him to live in a house with you with drugs and drugs paraphernalia. That's hood rat stuff. And so my first impression was right, and I hate that, you know, because I don't want to feed into stereotypes, but, you know, it is what it is. Now, as of today, Marie Holmes is still rich. But as any former lottery winner would tell you, you can go through that money rather quickly. As any professional athlete would tell you, the ones who have lost their money, you can go through it very quickly if you have a hood mentality. And unfortunately, it's evident that Marie Holmes has a hood rat mentality. And if she keeps that hood rat mentality, she's going to go through that money a lot quicker. And sometimes you have to change your locale. You have to change the people around you. And I know that means you can't necessarily keep it real. But unless you want to be real broke, you will change certain things around you. You know, I love the hood rat got rich story, man. It's a feel-good story all the way around. But so many times, hood rat get rich ends up being hood rat got broke again. Change your ways, Miss Marie Holmes. Keep that money if you can.
Today's topic, restorative housing reparations, Evanston style, from, in my opinion, most of the people, I didn't say all, but most of the people that want reparations have a hood rat mindset. I said most, not all. There has never been, correct me if I'm wrong, there has never been a person on the receiving end, including these lotto jackpots, from the thousands of government programs, entitlement programs, that have given grants, pay your rent, etc. There's never been not one person, if there is, call up and let me know during this live stream, that has been placed on the Forbes 400. Not one. There's never been one who's gotten handouts from the government or winnings from the government, if you call it winning, that has started a company and has been in the Fortune 500. Not one. Once again, if there is one, 619-768-2945, let me know. There's never been, since we're going black here, there's never been not a black person in the history of the United States thus far who has gotten anything from the government as far as a grant, Section 8, WIC, lottery ticket winnings, who has ended up on Black Enterprises Industrial Top 100. Not one. Anything, when you get stuff that way, is typically a fast track to a condition that you're worse off than you were when you before you even had the grant, the winnings, or what have you. But 619-768-2945 if you can show me one. So I'm looking at Evansville as a barometer now. Evanston, Illinois. There will be other towns around the United States that have majority black urban populations. And Asheville, North Carolina looks like they'll be number two, that are going to come up with their own definition of reparations. Because that's what Evanston, Illinois has done. Their definition of reparations has nothing to do with slavery. Their timeline starts at 1919. Slavery was abolished in 1863. The Juneteenth thing is when people in Texas found about it. That was 2 years later in 1865. So they made up their own definition of reparations. Asheville, North Carolina, and it's really, they're using reparations really as a marketing tool. They're using it as a marketing tool because it's you play it to the right audience, they're going to bite. These people, and they're politicians, they like to get elected, they like to be in the spotlight, so it's going to help some of them get reelected. Now, the politicians didn't, they're the front people. They're the showpiece. The people who really, whose agenda is the people who hired the lobbyists to get to the legislators to craft the bill the exact way they wanted it. People that hired the lobbyists are the people that are going to be on the receiving end. In other words, the real estate brokers, the contractors, the unions, those are the people who crafted that bill. And they're going to craft every bill. And now it would be nice. Now here's where I hope maybe, because I'm believing this is a fast track to help with some people. Hopefully, some of these people will get together. This is why I play Balling on Baltic so often. Hopefully some of these people that are going to get these reparation grants can get together in Evanston or Asheville or any other place and say, you know what, let's buy a whole block together. Now, let's say you got 16 people. Find a block in Evanston, Illinois of you really can't really do much with $25,000 anyway. But here's the thinking here. Let's get together and buy a block. Let's practice some group economics. With the way Evanston has crafted their reparations bill, and I'm sure Asheville is doing it too, and the way most people, because this might be rough, but most people, not all people now, most people who want this reparation stuff, in my opinion, have a hood rat mentality. Not all of them, but many of them. Because they're thinking like lone wolves. They're not thinking about, well, you know what? Let's all get together, 10 of us, 20 of us or 100 of us. Let's pool our resources, our reparations resources, and then do something that takes more effort than any one of us can do individually. And that's probably the number one thing that the majority of people who get government handouts basically don't rise. Once again, name one person who's been on the receiving end of a government-entitled program that's ended up in the Forbes 400, the Fortune 500, or the Black Enterprise Top 100. Name one. Emerson Miller, at best, and here's another thing about Emerson. I didn't roll up the clip on this. One lady that lives in Evanston that qualifies under Evanston's rules for restorative housing reparations, she said she doesn't want to own a house in Evanston because Evanston has very high real estate property taxes. So a lot of people, some of these people that get the house, if you can't afford to pay those yearly property taxes, you might end up losing the house. In any event, 619-768-2945, there will be other cities that jump on this reparations bandwagon because they haven't been able to pull it off on the federal level. But Evanston has been successfully, it's off the ground pretty high. By the end of the year, I'm sure they'll be doing stories on people who've actually received their $25,000 grants. They'll be holding press conferences of people buying their new home. There are also going to be press conferences of people who have renovated their homes with the $25,000 grant that they'll be getting. And in a few years from now, you'll be hearing horror stories when we hear some follow-ups that they lost the property because they couldn't pay the property taxes. Not all of them, but I'm sure you'll hear some horror stories like that. Asheville, North Carolina, and like I say, these cities, once one city does it, others will jump on board. So anyway, 619-768-2945, that's the number to call if you have any opinions on restorative housing reparations, Evanston style. And I suspect other cities like Cleveland, Ohio, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, any city that has a Democratic populace and a majority black population, or significant black population, I'll put it that way, significant black population, the reparations name or brand will be used as a marketing tool to get votes or what have you.
Kanye West, Grammy-winning musician, fashion designer, and now billionaire. Back in 2016, West himself declared he was over $50 million in debt. So how did he climb out of this hole, and where does his money come from? After a decade-long earnings analysis, Forbes can confirm that Kanye West is worth $1.3 billion. Though West grew famous for his music, his fortune comes mostly from his Adidas-powered Yeezy sneaker line. West receives around 11% royalty of Yeezy revenue, which in 2019 was close to $1.3 billion. West owns Yeezy outright, while Adidas manufactures and distributes the shoes, a dream team setup. As the markets begin to recover after free-falling in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, Adidas shares have surged, and so did West's wealth. Let's not forget his nice things. Private jets, Lamborghini, his new Wyoming ranch, and the Los Angeles home he shares with wife Kim Kardashian West. After crunching the numbers, we think it's safe to finally say, Kanye West is a billionaire.
And I call that do-it-yourself reparations. Everybody gets ideas, and you just got to learn how to monetize them. 314, your mic is open.
Hello, LA. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. And yourself?
You're absolutely right. I like, you know, some of my favorite entertainers is Kanye West, Tyler Perry. I really like what he's done. Lil Wayne and Floyd Mayweather. They are very, very good business people. And there's more. You can't name them all. And it's good to see these young, inspiring black Americans, African Americans, start progressing their way up to the top in business.
Mm-hmm.
Like 50 Cent and the things that he done, getting involved in vitamin water, purchasing his shares for, I think it was $70,000 he did. And turned around and sold for like, what, $350 million to Coca-Cola or something like that. I may not be that much, but it was real impressive. And, you know, those are things that you like to see.
Yep, yep.
Man, I sent you an email. Just here's some links of a St. Louis first-time housing program to assist people in down payments and also to acquire that house. And I know people who used it, but you know how they used it? I mean, where they used it. Years ago, when the politics in St. Louis changed, and I never lived in St. Louis except for real long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
I moved out of St. Louis first time that myself and a lot of others got a chance. But when the politics changed to where they was getting ready to elect a black mayor, Freeman Bowsley, which was a good mayor for business, by the way. I supported him for that. But they came up with this program with the Board of Aldermen that would assist people with their first down payments.
Mm-hmm.
Well, blacks and others took advantage of it because they was moving into South St. Louis, which is predominantly white. And whites who wanted to move because they seen the flood coming, that money was used to help blacks buy their home. Which a lot of them did. And here's the irony of it. The homes in North St. Louis was newer built brick homes than the homes in South St. Louis in that section, which was like your frame wood homes.
Mm-hmm.
With asbestos siding or asbestos board siding, and that's what they was buying. So I can't tell you what the neighborhood looked like now. I'll tell you one thing that through the run-of-the-mill Democratic policies, they brought in 80,000 Bosnian refugees and put them in South St. Louis. They didn't go to North St. Louis. They went to South St. Louis. And I think those Bosnians have created an economic enclave there. I think one Bosnian owned about an exuberant number of taxi cabs that he provide transportation, especially for Bosnians who at the time was coming into the country, hadn't established themselves economically. None of them was unemployed. They had their own businesses, restaurants, of course, and grocery stores, which specialize in their particular type of cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
But they still pushing those Bosnians. Just like Detroit, Bill Clinton was on a Clinton Foundation Economic Conference, stating that he would like to see Detroit redeveloped with Syrian refugees. Detroit has about 600,000 blacks in it. Ain't hardly no whites they left. And that's probably what happened.
They're probably moving back in. I heard it's getting gentrified up that way.
Well, that's a different type. Yeah, that's a different type of people.
You're right.
It really just ain't whites. Blacks come in and regentrify too. But that class of people that was there first left. Same thing is probably going to happen in Evansville. The whites, blacks in the one section of town in Evansville say that this section of town don't look as good as the one on the other side. Well, why come you've been there that long? Why not make it look just as good? I mean, landscaping, trees, grass, paint don't have no keen eye for the color of a person's skin. But anyway, we'll see.
Well, you know, one thing that can really, really change the look of a neighborhood while people are waiting on reparations and government grants and government handouts, something real simple, it happens all the time. The first step typically in a neighborhood transformation is picking up the trash.
Right. Yeah, you got some ratchet minds, a hood minds, if you want to call it like that, because you see these things in areas that's been labeled hood. And you're absolutely right. People put trash out. It's overflowing.
Even though
they pick up trash two times a week.
Something as simple as that, well, some people are waiting for somebody else outside of them, outside of their neighborhood, to do something, or the government to come in on to save them. Whoever comes in, the very first thing they do is pick up the trash.
Yeah. So St. Louis had one of these programs, and when people say, and see, here's another thing in the last few years, especially during Trump's mandate, you got a demonic news media that's out there that puts out these words, like the one lady, even though Democrats are against Evansville-type plans, I'm sorry, Republicans are.
Republicans.
Democrats are, too. Democrats are against those plans.
It's a group of people that are black that they don't – The bill that passed Evanston, they didn't like it. They said it's scrap it, but it was voted pro anyway.
Yeah, but the way she said it and applying it across the nation, she make it sound like it's just Republicans. And then, of course, they come along and say these are Trump supporters that's against it. Well, hell, like I said before, Democrats are against that also, but they never say the reality. They always want to slant and be biased. That's why I don't listen to them. And they are demonizing. That's what they're doing. And like you said, giving money to people, and I don't know, that should be challenging court if you're saying that it's only for blacks. And if you're using taxpayers' dollars, well, that ain't going to work. That's furthering segregation. I thought blacks was against segregation.
Well, let's look at what happened in Evanston. Now, I think Evanston, the majority of that town, I think it is white.
Is 20% black?
Yeah, something like that. Now, you know how politicians work, all right? The politicians, the black politicians who are the face of this in Evanston, all right, we don't know who they sold out or what the compromises were in order to get, because like Umar Johnson says, there are people praying, and the people praying were probably not black folks in the majority at all, if any.
They probably want to hear them get the hell out of the city.
Right. So, you know, let's at least in Evanston quiet some people down. Let's quiet them and give them some crumbs and call it reparations. Because, like the thing you sent me, FHA, the first-time home buyers thing, it's been around for decades. All Evanston is doing is the same thing, but they're calling it something different.
They calling it reparation. They could have had something in
it. They're calling
going.
It reparations. It's the exact same thing that's been around for decades, but now they're calling it reparations.
Yeah, you could have had a clean up the lot in the black communities and called it reparations. So it's just, you have silly these people get sometimes. What else do you have out there on the table?
Let's see. Well, that was the main thing today. Anybody else that want to comment, they can just press one. But hold it. Let me. Number one, like I've said a couple times on this podcast today, you'll see other cities that are going to jump on this thing, and they're going to brand something reparations that's been around in practicality for decades.
And let's talk about one other thing,
the exact same programs for veterans, single mothers, single fathers. How many ways can we call ground beef? We can take some ground beef and call it hamburger meatballs, Swedish meatballs. We can come up with 300 or more different names for ground beef.
Well, you know, like
at the end
heard,
of the day, it's ground beef.
Yeah, like you heard that protest, and you had people in the background hollering, "We built this country." Well, that's a lie. I don't know who the "we" is. And they never are explicit and detailed on who they're talking about. And those type of acquisitions are always level. But, you know, you talk about the disparity in income. They use the word wealth. Well, one of the things that helped alleviate a disparity in wealth, and I'm going to tell you something else. You got a lot of blacks in this country that's worth more than whites are, have higher income than white.
And you know what?
I'm
glad you brought that up because in Evanston, which is outside of Chicago, the Chicago metro area, I'm going to put it that way, Chicagoland as they call it, they probably have more black millionaires per square foot than any other. There might be two other places that might three, maybe. Maybe Atlanta metro area. Maybe PG County outside of D.C. and maybe Brooklyn, New York. Other than that, put it in the Midwest, Chicago has more black millionaires per square foot than anywhere in the Midwest.
And it got so bad for them, especially along North Shore Drive, which fronts the lakes. A news article had it with 3,000 millionaires, and they had to be talking about blacks, left because of the crime in the city. Well, apparently they had to leave and probably take a loss on what they was walking away from. Because if something is there that made them walk away, well, if they're trying to sell to somebody to get them to come and take their place, they're not going to see the worth that you probably would like for them to see, because what you are walking away from is still there. So these blacks that walked away, should they be compensated for the loss that they are having to deal with when the time comes for them to up and leave? Should they not have received a better value than what they was able to accomplish because of the crime? And we know who's causing a lot of the crime. Well, of course, then people are going to go into saying, well, it's because of this systemic. Well, then how the heck do these people become millionaires?
And you got them up
That's
in Chicago. You, matter of fact, just to name some, the late John H. Johnson, Ebony and Jet magazine, his daughter Linda is still living. So you got Johnson, you got George and Joan Johnson, Ebony and Johnson Products, Afro Sheen, those people. They're up there. You've got the late Travis Dempsey, real estate tycoon. He was Chicago.
It's a lot of them. You don't even hear their name.
There's
look
a whole
at the
bunch of them.
Of the top 20 black businesses that appear on Black Enterprise Top 100.
We're all out of Chicago.
About six or seven are involved in the automobile industry, which is centered around Detroit and Northern Illinois. So you're absolutely right. How do they get to where they are is the question. How do these foreigners come into the country and get to where they are? And here's another point. Many of your run-of-the-mill black politicians, look at the things that they are against. One being school choice, where we're talking about urban schools, where parents can take their children out of those districts and go elsewhere and be afforded to take their allocated monies with them. But it's your black politicians, Democrats, that don't want that. Going against the will and the wishes and the verbal outcry from the people, blacks, also Latinos. So why come they don't want these parents to be able to take their kids out of these schools? Well, it's simple. They want to create and maintain their own constituent that's put in a quote-unquote victimhood position so that they can always go to them and speak of what they conceive as their victimhood and get their support when it comes to election. It don't got so bad that when you got 800,000 black males and probably women too, I forget where gender this figure applies to. It may apply to both, or it may just be males, are in prisons. Now they want them to be allowed to cast votes while they're in prison. And guess who wants that? Some Democrats.
Evanston is 14 miles away from Chicago. It's a 33-minute drive.
Has the population increased? I doubt it. Those that flee in Chicago is not going to Evanston. They're going the other direction.
You know what? Like I said, I can't name from top to bottom. If you go from Chicago on up to the Canadian border and then go south all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, and let's say you go east all the way to Baltimore, and then let's see, west all the way out to, I'm going to say Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
More Chicago, hands down, and that's like a third of the United States.
How you spell that city?
Evanston. It's Evans and then T-O-N. I believe that's how you spell it correctly. That's why I looked it up. That has more black millionaires per square foot. Now, maybe Houston, Texas, or Dallas might, I'm not sure. But we can be here for next hour naming the black millionaires out of Chicago. And then if you go 40s, now, Evanston is only like 14 miles from Chicago. If you drive, 45 minutes to an hour to Pembroke and Hopkins Park, Illinois, those are two black townships. So there's quite a bit of money up there. So if anybody that lives in Illinois, if you listen to the podcast live stream right now, call in 619-768. Maybe y'all can explain it. What I'm just looking at it is business interest. And you know what? Since you do have so many black wealthy people up in that neck of the woods. There were probably some black people that were that hired some of the lobbyists, and they're going to get in on, you know, they're going to get in on the receiving end too. So I'll correct some of my comments on that. Because you do have some wealthy black folks up that way. It was Ariel, man. You're right. The black, there's a lot of black money up there.
Where is that?
You know, up in the Chicago, that whole Chicago metro area. And Evanston is part of it.
Blacks make up 16% of the population in Evanston.
As a matter of fact, historically,
the medium household income is $78,000.
Okay. Historically, many black folk that moved to Illinois, particularly that metro area of Illinois,
the population
is decreasing of the economic advantages that were there.
Yeah, the population is decreasing.
Well, what's happening up that way is those local municipalities, not only up there but nationwide, you know, it's those high property taxes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, Illinois is real with that. You know, Illinois, some of their government workers' pensions is in the $200,000 and $300,000 range.
Mm-hmm.
You imagine somebody who's retired from a government position, like someone that was official in prisons or some other government agency, and they retire, they receive $200,000, $250,000, $350,000 a year. I would say that's abuse, but, you know, who am I to say that?
Well, if there's a wealth...
The population, the employment has failed... close to 6% decline over a year, and the population is dropping.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would say is Evanston, being 14 miles out of the city, and the ones that's got this $78,000 medium income are people that's working in Chicago, probably in government jobs, and they live outside of the city to escape the other ravages of the city. But check this out. The most partisan county was Wayne County, I know, with 84.3% of the vote going to Donald Trump.
Wayne County, Michigan?
Wayne County, Illinois.
Oh, Illinois, okay.
Yeah, look up Data USA. It has a whole lot of good information. But overall, Illinois is a Democratic state. Donald Trump only got 21% in Illinois, where 75% went to Hillary Rotten Clinton. But if that's in that area. Now, if you look at the whole state of Illinois, the whole state of Illinois is either red or partisan. It's just up there in the northeast corner is where you have a lot of Democrats. And, of course, I don't even think... Cook County, I'd be interested to know what the political persuasion that is.
Well, most of the wealthy black folk in Chicago, not all, but many, are Republican.
So you got 18.2% of the population is born outside of the county, which equates to about 13.7 thousand people.
Let me see. Well, you know, I'm going to do a homework assignment.
Of course, you got
tomorrow
a lot of Hispanics.
We might be doing, somebody recommended, I think Warren Houston recommended, strange fruit. I think we might do a podcast on strange fruit tomorrow.
Yeah, do some podcasts on some successful blacks. People like to always talk about the victimhood.
You know what?
I think
what?
It does
You're
a misjustice.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, it
tomorrow,
does a misjustice.
Tomorrow we're going to do a whole podcast, 2 hours, on successful black folk.
When I talk about in politics,
we're going to go the entrepreneurial route.
Well, yeah, and families, and the ones that saved money for their children's college education, the ones who children qualified, prepared themselves and qualified for scholarships to pay for their education, the ones that's going to school, taking up the hard subjects, not philosophy, not childhood education, which is nothing wrong with those, but those don't pay big money. Let's look at the families, black families, as
achieving those things. Well, that's tomorrow's podcast. We're going to take a look at successful black families here in the United States, none of which have received a penny of government handouts in any way, shape, form, or manner from the government. That's tomorrow's podcast.
Absolutely.
Sure,
and have, you know, every other day have that.
Out of Illinois.
Have every other day on successes. Do a successful story on Warren Houston. He can be,
you know what, because we done had enough victimhood stories. We done had enough. Yeah, right. We done had enough victimhood stories. So, all right. Tomorrow we're doing all success, and I'm gonna take your advice. Every other day, we're gonna do something positive. We're gonna put out a story or bring on a guest that shares some of their success. Oh, it was speaking of which. The fourth Friday, thanks to Warren Houston, of next month, the fourth Friday in April, I think it's April 23rd, we will have Freeway Rick Ross on here. And he'll be giving how he actually, his success principles minus the drug trade.
And you know another thing on Evanston, you guess which is the largest race or ethnicity living in poverty? Guess. It's white.
And they do
white.
Have a lot of poor white people.
White.
See, a lot of people, man, you look, Appalachia is full of poor white folks. That's why I don't buy
Whites are more than three times in poverty than blacks are in this city. So you got
to
ask yourself.
Get a $25,000 grant.
Yeah, they don't want need to be getting the $25,000 grant.
At 346, I warn you, your mic is open.
Yeah, well, good afternoon, L.A. Bianca.
Hello, Mr. Success.
We working on it. Just talking about Freeway Ricky Ross, this is going to be a pretty good podcast because he's been keeping up under the low key, but he's pretty much recreated what he did before, you know, with his marijuana product. So he's doing real good right now. So I'm looking forward to that podcast. You know, if you got it.
Thanks for helping me get into contact with him.
Yeah, if you got
it. Warren, what's your take on what's going on in Evanston?
Man, I think it's a bunch of foolishness. You know, that's exactly what I think it is. And, you know, y'all basically cleared everything talking about. It's already a housing project that's been renamed. There's only one place that I can think of that truly deserves reparations in the United States, and that's Wilmington, North Carolina. Wilmington, North Carolina was literally the black folks. It was a black township that was very successful, that was literally ran out, burned, killed, shot up by the Democratic Party. Now, Wilmington, North Carolina, in my opinion, deserves reparations, but most of this stuff is foolishness.
Well, where is Hurston? Where is she from? You remember her?
Down in Eatonville, Florida.
Because down there, guess what? They were against Brown versus the board. Yeah, check this out.
Story.
Right. They was against Brown versus the board education in Eatonville. And it's another town in North Carolina that was against it. It was a school called Williston, W-I-L-L-I-S, W-I-L-L-I-S-T-O-N. Williston High School. They was against segregation. It was against busing, integrating school. Matter of fact, the court called their school to close. So those are stories that need to be brought out. Everybody want to talk about these crazy ass.
I'm going to follow your advice. Every other day, no less than 3 days a week, we're putting out podcasts on positive things that black folks have done without government aid.
Absolutely. Because you will find that those overshadow these other stories that people keep on pushing, languishing on. If they want to have shows on that, let them go someplace and have them shows. But your show should be about the positive, where people can get information. Warren, I sent you a whole lot of information on making money around something we were talking about. It just goes to show you that I have so much of that information.
Well,
I can't even remember what
I'm saying. When they used to do those Monday night talks, yeah. I think they were Monday nights. A few years ago, man, I took a bit of that information. That's how I got into Taft, Oklahoma, in the black townships. Just by he did a talk on it was one talk on unincorporated places, and then man, Warren, thank you. I can't thank you enough for that.
Municipal and municipal areas is incorporated cities. Then you have your unincorporated cities or unincorporated townships. A lot of those places are for sale.
I ran with that, man. I can't
buy the whole damn town.
Pianki, I'm glad you put that out because it's the frequency. Because you're right. Let other people talk about reparations.
Yeah.
Let other people talk about victimhood. And here, three times a week,
done, you have a headache. On
right.
Nausea. And Warren, what was that information I sent you on? I don't forget.
On basically getting my curriculum in the schools.
That's it. Right. Yeah. Look at all the opportunities. And see, this is where you take advantage of the atmosphere. You didn't create the atmosphere of victimhood, Black Lives Matter, police brutality. Well, hell, you can take advantage of it. And who would not want you to be able to have access and pay you for working with young people so they can avoid the pit holes and show them examples of how they're supposed to be performing and behaving, whereas they don't end up as a statistic or a headline story.
Right. Yeah. I agree.
Matter of fact, I think, Ellie, I don't know if Beasley's listening. He mentioned something. If he's interested in it, give him my contact information as well. Something he mentioned yesterday about the city.
He might be listening. I don't know.
But,
talk to him. Be sure you got your virus blockers up because it'll get on your phone.
Now, let's be positive now.
Yeah, but
Beasley's got 30 acres at least. He might have more than that, but Beasley's got 30 acres, so he's doing something right.
Well, at least if it was 40, I was going to say this. You probably got some Indian land. But no, that was on that issue there. Did you see where the white guy, white driver, motors, he was there in Illinois, right across the river from Missouri. I recognize this spot. Mm-hmm. And he refused to speak to the hotel. Not the hotel, but the police officer. And he was just using his rights to not speak to them. You don't have to say anything. Because they can use that against you, and sometimes they fabricate things. But you know how some people are. They want to get to talking about your mama and get into all sorts of things that they heard on court TV and all those things out there on the street.
All right. Well, all right, tomorrow we're doing all success story, black success stories without government help or intervention. That's tomorrow. Then from here on out, at least 3 days a week, every other day. If you got any success stories, share them with us. We'll put them out there.
I tell you what, I might get some people to call in.
Great. And, well, you know, we do need... you know what? The more people hear stuff that's positive and become aware
of
it, They might copy it. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we can look into getting people like Carol Swain, Larry Elder, Thomas Sowell, some of those other people, especially Thomas Sowell. Even though he's 90 years old, he's still talking. So he's good when it comes to finance and economics. Maybe we get some of these people on.
Yeah,
can you do two-way on your phone, Ellie?
Huh?
Can you do two-way on your phone?
You mean three-way?
Yeah, three-way.
Yeah, I can do it on my
landline.
Yeah, I can do it on my landline, yeah.
I might give you some phone numbers to call some people. When you get them on the phone, I'll tell them what's going on. I don't know how you do it on my phone. I probably do. I just got to study. I ain't smart and everything.
Yeah, I can do it on my landline number, yeah, which I'm on literally right now.
Okay. All right, well, look, I'm going to let you get off so you can probably get some refund on your car. So.
Okay, all right. Talk. Well, on that note, everybody, tomorrow we're doing all success stories. People without that government aid, on that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.